Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hi, welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Heather and I'm the chair of this week's podcast, and we will be talking about self-publishing. This week I'm joined by Steph, Linda, Teresa and Nicola.
Hello.
Hi.
Pat's not here in person, but I'm sure she's here in spirit. This week, Nicola will be reading from her work in progress. Steph will be amusing us with her thoughts for this week. Nicola and Graham Smith will be telling us what's on their bedside table. And we'll all be talking about our writing lives and where we're all up to. But first of all, Linda is going to ask us...
Name the novel.
I am indeed. And let's see, will Teresa get this on the first or second clue? Published in September 2014, this book immediately became an Amazon Best Book of the Month and was a finalist for the National Book Award. It has a solid 4 stars out of 5, over 3,390 reviews, so I think at least one of you will know it. But even so, I'll forge ahead. In this dystopian novel, civilization has collapsed. Oh, this okay. Is right down
there. That was clue down. One.
Well, there must be more to it than that.
No, it's a dystopian.
I only know one.
I only know one, too.
Of this era.
Clue two. Mm-hmm. A Russian plane crashed in the middle of North America, from which the virus spread.
Yeah.
Ah, they've got it. And wiped out the world we know. Shall I continue with them?
Oh, yeah. No, keep going, because the others might.
The story goes back and forth in time, from after the collapse to 20 years earlier and shortly before the collapse. Okay, we've got two people.
I can't remember who wrote it, but I think it's Station 11.
Emily something? Station 11?
Yeah. Emily hyphenated.
Emily St. John Mandel.
We call it St. John in the UK. We don't say St. John.
She's probably American, isn't she?
Well, I don't know if she is or not, but you know what? I'm just getting sick of all this. You guys don't talk right. You don't spell right.
I absolutely love that book.
I enjoyed that book.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
The one by Emily St. John Mandel.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Station 11. I would heartily recommend it.
I'm pretty convinced
I've read this on your recommendation.
Yeah.
I just didn't remember about the Aramis. So this is Russian plane.
Well, maybe I shouldn't say too much because I don't want to have spoilers, but it's the travelling theatre and stuff.
Yes.
So, Heather, you didn't join in and say you know what it is right away.
No, I didn't.
Well, I guessed it on the first clue and knew it on the second.
Okay.
Well, on the first clue, I thought, I only know one 21st century dystopian novel.
Yes.
It was that. Yeah. Good one.
Okay.
Over to Nicola, who's going to read from her work in progress.
Yes, a work in progress. She doesn't quite know what it is nowadays, but she's going ahead with it anyway. We'll figure that out later. Okay, so I've been trying to rewrite the first chapter, and this is the second half. You've already heard part of the first half where she's sitting watching the robin as she just got back from the funeral. Brianne took another mouthful of wine, barely tasting it. Her gaze dropped to the table, and she noticed the shell that the stranger had given her at the funeral. It was flat, chalky white on one side and pearlescent on the other, like the inside of an oyster shell. It was faintly warm to the touch. On the shiny side, a double spiral was engraved, and her thumb slowly followed the line around as she held it. It seemed to get even warmer as she held it. "Alec would have wanted you to have it," he had said, shaking her hand after the service and introducing himself as Jockey. Apparently, he had mentored Alex in a kitchen back in his apprenticeship days. She knew the name. She had heard Alec talk of him many times, but had just assumed he was dead long ago. Alec never kept in touch with people and had everyone tightly compartmentalised. "Out of sight, out of mind," he used to say, "and out of sight is the best place for most people." Jockey held on to her hand with both of his for a bit longer than was comfortable. He was tiny, and she had to lean in to hear what he was saying. "He found it on the beach after one of our epic nights out in the early days and always loved it. I found it when I was clearing out a box of stuff he left behind when he moved out of our flat. Funny how it always feels so warm. Anyway, you should have it now." Jockey hadn't been at the reception line in the hotel local to Alec's mother's house. Typical Brianne thought, keep it convenient for you and all his friends. Now I won't be able to have a drink until I get home. possibly just as well. She had wanted to ask Jockey some more about their early days chefing together, but he'd vanished in the melee to get out of the crematorium car park. She stood and poured another large glass of wine, gazing out at the garden again. The olive tree shivered in the wind, and Brianne was glad she hadn't put any pansies in yet. The frost would have killed them by now. It was still so cold, as cold outside as she felt inside. The robin had disappeared now, gone off hunting over the rest of his territory for something to eat. Brianne took her glass and the bottle and walked upstairs slowly, leaving her phone on the kitchen table, but still holding the shell. Its warmth was strangely comforting in the cold house. The heating had not yet kicked in, and there was no point in putting it on now. She went to the chest of drawers and put the glass down, heedless of the wet ring it made immediately. She smiled, thinking how mad Alec would have got, seeing that ring. He was always more house-proud than she was. She stood at the window for a minute, looking out with unseeing eyes, then took the white boxes out of the top drawer, held neatly together with an elastic hairband. Boxes carefully accumulated over the last month or so, since that terrible morning, the morning when her world came to an end.
Wow.
I think it's got a nice pace. It's really measured and builds well. Mm-hmm. Well written and atmospheric. So, you know, on the whole, I thought I think it's very good. I didn't have a lot to say, a couple of typos, which I won't, you know.
There's always loads of those.
You do repeat in the second little paragraph, as she held it, it seemed to get even warmer as she held it. Oh, so right. I've suggested maybe the second time, say it seemed to get even warmer in her hand or something that. It's just a little bit, because it's very close together.
And you do labour the fact that it seemed warm, and then Jockey says it's warm, and then it's warm and she's carrying upstairs. So maybe...
maybe it's a little bit,
Too mentioned a bit too often, but that will come out in a
minute. And I think the only other thing of any significance, when she's talking about the guy who introduced himself as Jockey, apparently he had mentored Alec in a kitchen. You don't need because in the next thing you say that Alec had talked about him.
Yes,
so she knows who he is. When he says Jockey, she's like, oh, I know.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's, well-written piece. I didn't have a lot to say.
I wondered why she assumed he was dead.
I wondered that too.
Are we talking about age?
No, just because she'd never met him.
Right.
Yeah.
I just wondered.
But at the same time, you say he compartmentalized people.
So I don't need to say.
So, maybe there's a little contradiction there.
And I didn't understand chefing, but then you could be right and I could be wrong. I didn't understand why there was an apostrophe in there.
Oh, there isn't. I looked this up because...
I meant to.
A spell checker doesn't like chefing with one F or with two Fs, but I looked it up and chefing with one F is good enough. It's allowed in Scrabble and that's good enough for me.
Oh, God. And the only other thing for me was when she went to the chest of drawers and put the glass down, heedless of the wet ring it made immediately. I don't think you need immediately.
No, I made a note of that. Yeah, that's an unnecessary word.
It wouldn't happen immediately, would it? It would just sit.
Well, no, because it's only when you pick it up you'd see the ring.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I picked up on that as well. There was a couple of areas where I thought you could probably do with tightening up a bit. We talked about as she held it. I thought compartmentalised was a good word. And you didn't need it to be tightly compartmentalised. So I think you could drop the adverb.
Okay. I didn't run this one through anyway.
I thought it was really harsh of her when she says, typical, keep it convenient for you and all his other friends. I keep it convenient for everybody but me.
But do you remember when we read the first bit of this, we said, if you want us not to like her, you've got to...
That's what I've said. I thought she was harsh. The note I've made.
I wanted to be not a perfect hero.
I understand abrasive, that. I liked that. Another adverb alert on walked upstairs slowly. You could maybe say trudged upstairs plodded upstairs or something that implies walking slowly. Yeah. But again, that's for you. I really liked the short paragraph about the robin, and in the last part you've got the robin had disappeared now. I don't think you need to say he'd gone off hunting because she doesn't necessarily know that the robin disappeared.
But she's speculating.
I'm not sure. But the fact is, you've got a short paragraph that the robin had disappeared now. Then you've got some really you know what we talked about the last time you read about writing the fast bit slow. Mm. You're doing that really well here. you're saying she took her glass, she walked upstairs, she left her phone on the table, she was holding the shell was warm. You're actually doing what we talked about last time. The heating hadn't kicked in and it wasn't put on. So you've got...
There's quite a lot of detail going on.
You've got
about
three longer paragraphs giving absolutely minute detail of her journey upstairs and getting us prepared for whatever's going to happen.
Yes,
and then at the very end, that short paragraph at the end, again, the morning when her world came to an end, that's why I think actually if you can even just say the Robin had disappeared now, then take us through that long journey and then the morning when her world came to an end, because like, I've got goosebumps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think that build was fabulous, and it's exactly what we talked about last time when you were talking about the falling.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know, about really getting down to specific things. And, you know, that the glass made a ring on the top of the thing, and she thought of Alec.
Yeah.
And how he would have been irritated by it. I think it's...
I might be improving.
I think that's probably what I meant when I said it's well-paced, but I didn't analyse it or, you know, I couldn't express it as well as Stephanie did. But,
Well, one of the things I thought of when I was reading is the shell, Alec left it, and that shell seems to me to be a part of the world that, you know, when she's going in with Rex. But Alec left it for her.
Good that you're picking up that there's something about
that
shell.
Yeah. I thought it was a clever thing because I was reading and I thought, Alec. Yeah.
So when you go, keep interrupting. So you're going to a scene where they're choosing somebody and then are you going to the resuscitation? And, you know, you're going to skip the resuscitation.
I did think about tacking the resuscitation scene on the end of this, but I've decided I don't think I need
this
it.
This can end... I've
rearranged all the scenes now, and then it's flowing much better for me now.
Brilliant.
So I'll put them all up in you know, so you can have a look.
I'd love to see the whole thing from start to finish.
It's starting to look like a book now.
Yeah. And I did wonder, is Jockey real?
Well, who knows, eh?
Yeah.
Watch this face. He's small, isn't he? Could be a leprechaun.
I did like, actually, another note that I made, it's a minor thing, really. He was tiny and she had to lean in to hear what she was saying. If you have her leaning down to hear what he's saying, that will give us the image of somebody that's tiny. You don't need to tell us, but you know, it's a minor thing.
No, I need to do more showing, not telling.
Thank you very much. He was tiny because it gave me more of a visual method. This wasn't like Heather. I wondered, is he real or not? And then he just disappeared. So
to give the shell,
I like
messenger of some kind.
Yeah.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
And over to Steph, who's going to amuse us.
Well, I hope so, yeah. Several weeks ago, I talked about some tea leaf stealing Miss Skin and Blister's purse. Do you remember?
Yeah.
And it had a monkey in it.
Yeah.
Left her in a bit of a 2 and 8. And somebody quite rightly asked me where a monkey came into Cockney rhyming slang.
Right.
Of course it doesn't, because money in Cockney rhyming slang would be bread and honey, money, or bread.
Uh-huh.
And bread obviously has become a word for money and dough, right. Bread and dough, right. And all the rest of it. So I then thought, where does monkey come from? So I did a little bit of investigating because it was better than writing something. And a monkey is thought to derive from the days of the Raj. The days of the British Raj in India.
Yeah. Okay.
When a 500 rupee note bore the picture of a monkey.
Ah.
And it's thought that the soldiers brought the term monkey back to Britain. And there are lots of slang words for money, and I could probably talk about them for an hour or more. As I said, investigating them proved a very good procrastination fodder. But moolah was one word I found which has references all over the globe. Moolah, as in money.
Yeah, I know that one.
I'm sure everybody's heard of it.
Yeah.
The worddetective.com proposed that moolah comes from the French le moulin, meaning the mill. I didn't quite get the link between mill and money.
I don't either.
So I wasn't convinced by that. David Cassidy, in his book The Secret Language of the Crossroad, suggested it could come from the Irish phrase mol oir, O-I-R, which means a pile of gold.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a possibility.
Who knew David Cassidy wrote books?
Yes. I was thinking of that.
I haven't seen Nicola's face.
Not the same David Cassidy, Nicola. It's a different one. Please. Not David Cassidy as in the Partridge Family, another David Cassidy. Or maybe it's from the Romany word, mull, which means worthy.
Right.
So there's lots of theories, but the one I favour, and this is the one I'm going to present to you, is that it comes from the Spanish. Mula is a mule, and in all Spanish-speaking countries, the mule was as good as cash. Mm. And in fact, in Venezuela, Bajate de la mula literally means get down off your mule, but it's an idiom for pay up. It could be that mula is about money.
Yeah.
In Pali, which are early Buddhist scriptures, the word mule actually means money.
Right.
And in Bengali and Sanskrit, mula is price or value.
Mm-hmm.
And in South Indian languages, mula means valuables. So your mula would be.
So again, it may have come from the Raj.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think with Roman, Spanish, Hindu and Sanskrit languages, Buddhist languages, they all share that ancient root. So to me, that seems like the most the most likely route.
Yeah.
So yeah, mula. For money.
And what's a pony?
Oh, it's £25, I believe.
I always get mixed up with a pony and a monkey.
I think a monkey is £500 and a pony £25, I believe. Okay. Yeah, so the thing about people referring to banknotes by the images on them is not uncommon, because in the US people refer to Lincolns, Benjamins and Jacksons.
Right, they do.
So Benjamin Franklin is on a $100 bill, and Andrew Jackson on the 20, and Abraham Lincoln on the 5, I believe, Linda. Yeah.
And George Washington on the 1.
Yeah, or they might just say dead presidents when they're referring to paper money in general.
Nice. I like that. Awesome.
Well, thank you very much. Now, we're going to talk about what we're up to. So I'll start. I mentioned previously that I'd written a play. My play has now been accepted by Andrew, and we're going to have a series of workshops to build the characters, and generally everybody was happy with it.
You know what you need to do, don't you? You need to keep a diary of this process, because it would be a great book.
Yes, I could do. That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Oh, well,
so the read-through went well.
It went really well, and it actually made people laugh.
Oh, brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
Good. Well done.
That's fabulous.
That's fabulous.
Just do it when you think about it.
It's exciting.
Or maybe we can get a recording of it and put it out as a podcast.
Yeah.
And what was it like hearing people read?
It was very different, because I suppose the expressions that I got in my head weren't necessarily what people put into it. And that was good, listening to the different people. And because when I'm reading it to myself or out loud, it's just me.
Mm.
And so it was very interesting listening already to the interaction between the characters. Mm. And then the suggestions that people came up with were very positive. It was really good.
Because their expressions were different, and they fell on different words, et cetera, did any of that disturb you, or was it okay?
It didn't disturb. I was worried about it. I was worried about a lot of things, you know, worried that they'd laugh at me because they thought it was awful. But no, it didn't bother me. It didn't upset me. Nothing upset me about the whole thing.
Really good.
Yeah. Everybody just enjoyed it, and even the people that were reading it for the first time enjoyed it, which was good. And
that's great. Good.
Excellent.
Well done.
Proud of you. Yeah. Teresa, what are you up to at the moment?
Well, I'm steadily working away at Ronella the Goat Girl, working title. I need a better title than that, but we'll think about that later. So I'm up to 13,000 words.
Woo!
I'm quite happy. I'm very happy. I'm not obsessed with word count, but it does give me that feeling of progress at the end of the day, and in my spreadsheet, my little sum is going up.
Right.
I've been doing a bit of housekeeping with it as well. So having a little pause, having reached a significant point in the narrative. So I've put the separate chapters into one document. So I've put the first 9 chapters into one document, 9, 10 chapters. I'm checking the names, because I have changed people's names part way through, and then sometimes they've got a different name in a different chapter, and I need to fix all that.
That happens to me all the time.
Yeah, me.
Updating.
Alec and Alex.
Yeah, updating the spreadsheet, looking for holes in the narrative. Is there something I should have told the reader that I haven't? And the other thing that I've done, which is really scary, I sent it to some 10-year-old beta readers, the story so far, which is perhaps a quarter of a novel, but I haven't heard back yet, so I'm on tenterhooks waiting to hear what Florence and Jude think of it. And I know that Linda and Stephanie have said they might send it to their grandchildren. I'd be very happy for you to do that. With, you know, ask them some pertinent questions, you know, what they think isn't working, that kind of thing. And the other little thing that's happened, somebody on social media that sent out a call for submissions, and this guy is starting a new magazine for nature and travel writing called Total Eclipse, and he's asking people to submit short pieces. There's no fee, but I contacted him and said, would he be interested in the thing that I wrote about a year ago called In the Footsteps of Jules Verne.
Because
it would be nice to find a home for it, which is just the story of a walk that I took in Greece, but in a place that Jules Verne had visited and written about. So I haven't heard back, but he's looking at it. And I thought, you know, there's no fee, but at the end of the day, if he gave me a fee, it would be £20-30, which is nothing, but it's not life-changing as a one-off payment. Mm-hmm. And better to support a new publication and have it on my CV,
on your CV
if he accepts it. Right. So that's another little thing that I've done.
Yeah. That's great. Well, you know, that piece about, you know, In the Footsteps of Jules Verne inspired me to order the book.
Oh, yeah.
And both Hal and I read it and loved it. So, that was a good piece.
The, what's it called? The Archipelago on Fire by Jules Verne. Yeah.
Stephanie, what are you up to now?
Well, I had a bit of a lull in the old writing, as you might remember, and I was catching up on my Sudoku. Although every time I read a book, another one seems to take its place. It's like there's a fairy in my house. But no, I'm actually getting really stuck into the plotting of my next novel now. So I'm enjoying that process. Lots of little white cards with scenes on and rearranging them and sticking them up on pin boards and that sort of thing. But no, I'm really getting scripts with the characters now as well.
Brilliant. Look forward to your work in progress in the future.
Thank
you. Nicola, I've done the opening hook of the main book, and I'm now getting stuck into the middle sort of biggest section, which is a bit daunting to be staring down the barrel of all those words to be written. So I'm distracting myself with the idea. I had a fabulous afternoon on the beach last year reading a book of short stories, because I don't normally like short stories, but I did by the end of that afternoon have an idea for about 5 or 6 different stories, all based in the same village, but supernatural and science fiction kind of stories. And so I've had an idea for one, and I've roughed it out, and that's why I was so interested to listen to our short story episode, because I was waiting for tips for that. Because I wanted to know if, you know, your scene should be shorter, or if you have less scenes in a short story and things like that. But I really want to get it done, because I really want to start submitting short stories to science fiction magazines and start getting some feedback from people who read science fiction.
You could call the village the Twilight Zone.
Or whatever.
Oh, I think that might have been done.
Yeah, I think that's been taken. But you gave me some great ideas about how to name my village the other day. So I feel we're on the way now.
Yeah.
Thank you. And Linda.
Well, I'm pleased to say my pages are piling up. And I'm enjoying very much knowing where I'm going for a while, you know. So it makes it easier to write, doesn't it?
Well, this is what I found. Yes. Yeah. It took me 10 years to work it out, but there you go.
And I too wanted to make something, a short story that I might enter into a competition somewhere. And I have previously written short pieces that aren't cleaned up, and I've been thinking about going back and doing that, but then I thought, well, I'm really, really enjoying right now where I am with Mary Magdalene and Eli, so I'm not sure that I want to get distracted by
it. It's best to go with that, I think, while the muse is with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. Couldn't agree more.
And just this morning, speaking of Sudoku, just this morning in the mail arrived another book, which brought me up to 98.
Well, the one you've forgotten you'd ordered.
Thank you, Linda. Now, as I said, our show this week is focusing on self-publishing.
So we've got some great advice from a few of our guests. Let's listen to Bambi Lynn, Peter Flannery and JF Penn sharing their experiences. Bambi Lynn says, sorry for the dog barking in the background. We couldn't cover it up or we would have had no interview at all.
Hi, Bambi. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today.
Can you tell us, you started out being published by traditional publishers, but now you're self-publishing, right? Why did you make the switch and how's it working for you?
I started out with a traditional publisher. This was about 2011, 2012. I knew nothing about the publishing world, how to get a cover, how to find an editor, any of those, anything. I didn't know anything. I was published with this publisher for my first three books. They're called Red Sage, is the name of the publisher. And I learned an awful lot. I learned so much about every little aspect of the publishing process. With that publisher, I had no control over anything. They sent me a picture of my cover with a woman with blonde hair, and my heroine had red hair. I sent it back three times and still never really got red hair. So that's one of the things, is the control that you have as the publisher. When you're doing everything, you are in control of everything, which can be kind of daunting. I'm not a control kind of person, so I don't feel like I need that. But a lot of people love having control of every single thing that has to do. But that's one thing, is having control of who your editor is. Is it somebody who really gets your writing and it's not making you change things that you really believe in? Also, are you going to be able to get the cover that you want? If you don't like your cover, you can make your cover artist do another one, or you can get a different cover artist. So there are a lot of different things that you can do when you have control of all the process. The other thing is the money. The money is unbelievable. With my publisher, I got 6%. Now I get 75%.
Yeah.
And the difference between making a living, I don't think you can make a living with a traditional publisher, do you think?
And what would you say, Bambi, to the people who want to go with a traditional publisher because they think they won't have to do the marketing?
Unless you have a bestseller, a publishing company is not going to put anything into you. Unless you have a lot of success coming up behind you, you're already well-known, you already have a large following, all of that marketing is going to fall back on you. Even when I was published with a traditional publisher, and my friends that I have who were published with traditional publishers, the publishers do not put money into marketing for them. Lower level writers, mid-list writers, they just, for one thing, publishers don't have the money to do it anymore because, you know, they're hurting pretty bad these days too with self-publishing. And so they don't have a lot of money to put into marketing, and the money they do have, they're going to put into their big authors.
So doing your own marketing, having control of your creative, and then getting a buzz going so that your book moves up the Amazon charts and starts being shown next to other books like it. That's sort of the formula now then.
Yes, absolutely.
And how difficult is it to self-publish? Is it fairly straightforward?
It really is not complicated at all. You know, it's just a process. It's time consuming. You kind of have to do your homework. The two big expenses I have are my cover artist and my editor. Yeah. And you can expect to pay a cover artist, a good cover artist, anywhere from $200 to $500 for a good cover.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even more, depending on how original it is. If you are using, you know, royalty-free stock photos, you're going to pay $300 to $500. Yeah. If you hire someone to have a photo shoot and do an actual artist rendition of a cover for you, then you're talking more in a couple of $1,000s for a cover, but you'd have something that's more unique. So it kind of depends on what you want to spend. For an editor, you can find an editor that's so-so, that's just starting out, doesn't have a large clientele, for $500 to edit a 60,000-word book. Or you can pay up to $3,000 for someone who's a really good editor and that kind of thing. You also pay for different kinds of editing. You get a line editor, which is editing for grammar and punctuation and those types of things. And then you have a developmental editor who's editing you for your sentence structure and your conflict and your motivation and all of, you know, your story development. So sometimes you might have two editors. Sometimes you might have one that does both. I personally don't pay for a line editor because I was an English major in college, and I'm kind of very skilled at grammar and punctuation, that kind of thing. So I really don't need that. But a developmental area editor, I try to put a lot of money into that because that's where I feel like is a weakness of mine.
And then to get your name out there and your book out there, is it just a matter of doing all of this online stuff? Is that the kind of thing you do to get yourself known, just to be online? Or no, you go off to different fairs and conferences and things too, don't you?
First and foremost is you have to be online. That's where all the people are. The whole world is online, and you have to be there. And you do, you need to be everywhere. You need to have a website that everything you do can funnel back to that website. And because a lot of times, let's say you buy a marketing spot, and in the back of your book, you have a link to Amazon and Kobo and Barnes and Noble and all the places where your book is for sale, you have a link. Well, the next thing you know, you're going to get an email back that says, oh, we cannot market your book because you have illegal links in there, which are links that compromise each other. So you're like advertising your book in two places. So Amazon is competing with Barnes and Noble because you got both their links in the back of your book.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes.
So what you really need is just a link to your website that has Amazon, Barnes and Noble. And then once they get to your website, they can just click on those links. It's one extra click that they have to do, but it saves you a lot of time and headache when you try to market your book to a place that can't have multiple links like that. So you absolutely want to have a website that's your base, and then you need to have a Facebook. I have two things. I have a Facebook page, and I have a Facebook group.
Yes.
And a page is where I started. They used to have them. They used to call them fan pages. Back in the beginning, Facebook called them fan pages. But then groups got to be more popular, and so now I have a group. And I find my group to be more interactive. I can talk to my fans. They can interact with me a lot more than they can on page, or maybe just more than they do on page. So I definitely recommend having a Facebook group. And I also have a separate Facebook profile. So I have my personal Facebook profile where all my friends are and all my students are and friends I had when I was in high school and all that kind of stuff. Then I also have a separate Facebook profile that's for Bambi Lynn. And there I just post, you know, pictures of hot guys and funny things for my book and, you know, things like that. So, and then I have an Instagram account that I use that. And then I have Twitter, but I don't really, my Facebook links to my Twitter. So whatever posts on my Facebook goes to my Twitter as well. So I kind of kill two birds with one stone, but I'm not very interactive on Twitter. Yeah. But, you know, you need to be all of these things, all of the places that you can possibly be. Yeah. Now, as far as the fairs I go to, I'm a medieval fantasy Renaissance fair junkie. I could go to one every weekend. I can be there when they open. I can stay till they close both days of the weekend that they're open. But my husband would shoot himself. So we go, and we usually spend a couple of hours, and I'm never ready to go in time. So one of the things that I sculpt are these little dragons. And so I thought, well, you know, I could sell those dragons at the Renaissance Fair and also have my books there. And I have this big poster one of my book covers, and the female's face is cut out of it. So it's like a photo op. And so people just came through there. Oh my gosh, all day long, even if they didn't buy anything, they took their picture with that thing with my name on it. And they all went home and posted pictures of themselves on the romance cover with my name on it. So any just little things like that you look for. And there are several writers' conferences that I go to, but I really love to go to reader events, reader luncheons, reader conferences. A couple of the big ones, they're not really going to be having them anymore, like the Romantic Times Readers Convention was one of the best things that I went to. It was just readers and parties for readers and masquerade balls and cover model contests and all of these kind of things. And that's where you really meet a lot of readers, obviously. When I go to writers' conferences, I enjoy them and I get a lot out of them, a lot of good workshops and things like that. But you don't really meet a lot of readers except for ones who are also authors, which are good too, but they don't spend their money as prolifically as readers do. So, yes, I love going to reader events. Barbara Vey has a big one that she has, and it's just a luncheon. But her luncheon's turned into a weekend thing. But luncheons are really big for readers, and you give away books, and you give away baskets and stuff. And I picked up a lot of readers that way. It's hard. You're always looking for something. I find myself watching commercials on TV and noting, what are they doing to draw in their audience? What are they doing to draw in their customer? How are they, and how can I do that?
Well, my name's Peter Flannery. About 6 years ago, I gave a talk on self-publishing to one of our local community groups. And I actually met several people there who were working on books, and a couple of women who were published authors. And now we're part of a little group called the Scribblers. When we first started meeting, we were all working on books. So there was this great excitement about, you know, how's the book going and what are you struggling on and how should I do this and what do you think of point of view? And then we all got closer and closer and closer, and we got to the point where we were finishing our books and publishing them. Most of us are self-published. And then, of course, you cross that boundary from being an excited author to being somebody who's trying to sell books. And that's like a different, it's a whole different set of skills that's required. With First and Only, when I finished that, I sent it out to a number of agents and publishers and just ended up with a whole string of, you know, rejection slips.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I was quite surprised and a little hurt. You know, you've got that disappointment, which is horrible to take. But I thought to myself, actually, I think this book's okay. You know, I was quite pleased with it. But I thought to myself, I could spend the next year, 18 months, sending out one submission after another, after another, after another, and just waiting 2 or 3 months for a rejection slip. And this was in 2011. So it was just at the time when self-publishing was starting to make its presence, you know, more widely known. So I thought I'd give it a go. I published the book in the spring of 2012, and at first it hardly sold anything. I think in 10 months it had sold something like 40 copies. And then I made just a couple of small changes. I reduced the price a little bit, and I put a little thank you in the back of the book, and just some small changes. And whether it was those changes or whether it just needed to reach a certain threshold, it suddenly started taking off. You know, it sold a few 1 month, and then it sold more the next month, and then more the next month. And it just went up and up and up. It was the most amazing sort of roller coaster. And it got to the stage where it was maybe selling, I don't know, 1,500 copies a month. And yeah, I was blown away by this. So that proved to me that it could be done as a self-published author. So when I'd finished Battle Mage, I didn't even send it out to anybody. I thought to myself, okay, I've got this book. I'm fairly pleased with it. You know, I feel as if I've done a pretty good job. I feel as if people will like it. So let's just publish it and try and make a success of it. So I didn't even look for an agent or publisher. I just published it myself. It's a tricky balance because on the one hand, I think it's great that we all have this opportunity to self-publish. And it's great to hear of people who've done really well, you know, with self-publishing. But it's no guarantee of success. All it does, it allows you a seat at the table. It allows you to get into the game. Once you release your book, it's all about the book. It's all about how much people enjoy your book. And it's almost, you have to cross kind of a threshold. We've all read books that we finish and we think, yeah, it was okay. But you're never going to go to work and tell people about it. So I always say to people that the best marketing thing you can ever produce is the book itself.
I'm a businesswoman. I've always run my own businesses. And back when I had my first nonfiction book, so this was 2008. So this was before the Kindle, before smartphones, if people can remember that, you know. So back then, and I was in Australia, so I did look at the traditional publishing industry. And as a businesswoman, I was not happy with the level of contract that they were offering. I understood the creative side of writing, but equally there's a business side to publishing and marketing. And I could not see why I would give up 90% of my income for what? the publishers were doing with those books. And then, of course, what happened is the Kindle arrived about a year later, and print on demand. And since then, audiobooks, all the possibilities that we have now. So I have ebooks, print, audiobooks, large print, hardbacks, all of which are print on demand. I don't hold stock. I just get money. So basically, I call myself an independent author. I work with professional freelance editors, cover designers. I work with about 11 different contractors. So I run a publishing company. That's quite different, potentially, to someone who might not have a budget, for example. I chose from day one to be independent. And as of this point, you know, I've sold books in 86 countries around the world, far more than I would have done going the traditional route. Now, I certainly wouldn't write it off. It all depends on contracts. So, for example, I recently signed a deal for Korean rights. I've done German, French, Italian, Spanish. Yeah, I mean, all of these things are possible. What I would urge people is to separate your creative mind from your business mind. And if you can keep them separate, certainly if you're listening and you're working on your first book, forget about publication, forget about marketing. Just work on that book. Mm-hmm. And once you are at a fate, and then work with an editor, even if you're going to go traditional, still work with an editor to get your book into the best shape it can be. And then you can think about publication later. And then back on the number of books, I think what happens once you've written that first book, I almost think of it as clearing the pipe. I think there's like a pipe. And once you've cleared that first book from your head, then comes the decision of whether you're going to do it again. And obviously, I'm someone who went, oh yeah, I'm going to do this again. And as we speak, I'm 10,000 words into the next novel in my dark fantasy series, my Matt Walker series. So, I mean, as soon as I finish one, I'm ready to go again.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I listened to Moneybox on Radio 4 a few weeks ago, all about the economics of being an author. And I'm not completely converted to self-publishing. I still have this idea that I want the kudos, the recognition that comes from being chosen by an agent, being chosen by a publisher. Mm-hmm. And also, none of us sitting here are likely to make, well, Nicola aside, are likely to make a living from writing. You know,
Why do you say that?
Because I'm not going to write a bestseller. I'm not working in that.
Why do you think I would write a bestseller?
I think the science fiction and the self-publishing works for science fiction, it and does, you get loyal yeah. followers, yeah. And you're already planning a trilogy. So you're an expert at online marketing. So all
not
of those
books, though. I know nothing about.
No, but all of those things. Anyway,
yeah.
What I'm saying is, it's not that I expect to make a fortune from writing ever if I get published, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's just the fairness of it. When that an author says, you know, my book's selling for £9 and sometimes I get 10p.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's
economics
not
do
wrong.
Right. No, and Bambi work. Said, you know, Bambi said when she was being published by publishing house, she was getting like, what was it, like 6% or something. And now with self-publishing, she comes out with about 50% after she's paid off the copy artist and the, you know, the et cetera.
Yeah, and I think that was interesting what she said about, you know, cover design and all of that. Yeah. You've got to invest then. You've got to find somebody and pay them to design your cover.
Right.
You know, so it's that upfront investment, which is a bit daunting, especially as one of the things about writing is it is kind of a cost-free thing to do. Mm. You know, you pick up a pen, you write. And so I think many people, you know, are not in a position to say, well, here's 500, you know, for cover design. But it's certainly worth thinking about.
The scary thing is that there must be people that have invested all of that time and money into self-publishing and have got nowhere.
Yeah.
And that's just, that for me.
Because they don't know about the marketing, But the marketing, you know, I didn't know about writing when I started. And now I'm finding all these these structures and guidelines and things. And it's exactly the same with marketing a book. There are quite a few books on marketing a book. I mean, one of my friends wrote a book on how to get an Amazon bestseller, an Amazon product to the top of the charts in Amazon. And he wrote a book. Then he did it. He actually got his book to the number one.
Really?
Yeah. And there are people who, for very not much money at all, you know, in the realms of about £1,000 to £1,500, will take a non-fiction book or a fiction book and will do all the marketing for you. So there are books you can buy to find out how to do it yourself, and then there are people you can pay to do it. And I think, you know, if you have got some cash, or there's also the crowdfunding option, isn't there?
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I think when I finished Runella, I am going to go the conventional route. But if it doesn't...
How long will you give it?
That's I don't know. How many rejections?
I don't know. I think you've got to be ready to go for 100.
Yeah, because
everybody said that we've interviewed.
Just
put them out quickly, one after the other. Bang, bang, bang.
But I used Book Printing UK to print my journal, but they also offer other services.
Yeah.
So they'll do the editing and the layouts and the covers and that sort of thing for you. And I think even beyond that, they will help you. I just use them purely to print what I'd done.
Yeah. And, you know, things like... Daphne Capsali's just changed the cover on her book because she felt that the cover wasn't reflecting what the book was about, and it actually more accurately matches her other book now. You know, so she's building a sort of brand look. And
yes, when they look like a set.
Yeah, you don't have to pay £500. There are people on Fiverr.com that will do it for you. Editing, I think, is the thing to invest in.
Yes, because I agree.
If you've got a good story and it's well edited and it's got a great cover, and then you read a book on how to work the Amazon algorithm to make it work in your favour so you get shown next to other books, I think you're onto a real chance for this.
Right. But from my point of view, where I'm at now is make this the best book that I can.
Yes.
You know, the rest comes afterwards. Yeah, it's then how you... Because I want children to read it. That's it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I want to buy it for my grandchildren for Christmas.
Christmas, there's a deadline.
All right, maybe not this Christmas. They're not 10 yet. Okay, we're almost at the end of our podcast, but first Nicola and Graham Smith are going to tell you what's on their bedside tables. Nicola.
Right, so as is my wont, when I find an author I like, I'm working my way through everything Michael Marshall Smith's written. I was sent some books of his by one of my clients, and a lovely, wonderful surprise present. And I've just tracked him down online and found him on Twitter and done all that stuff. And I'm now reading his book, The Straw Men, which is interesting because he's a Brit and he's lived in America for about 20-odd years, I think. And this book is now written and set in America, but his Britishisms still come through. So I'm really enjoying it so far. It's a thriller, and it is quite thrilling already, and I'll let you know how I go with the rest of it.
All right.
Thank you. And now we'll hear from Graham.
I've just finished Lee Child's Past Tense. It's the latest in his very enjoyable Reacher series, and I think that with the Reacher series, I've read every one over the years, and I love the character. I love what he does with Reacher, but what he's done this time just seems to have taken that step up. You always expect that you're going to get a 4.5-star read every time with me. But this time, for the first time in probably about 4 or 5 books, he's not just hit 5-star, he's surpassed it. You know, he really has pushed the boundaries and written one of his best books in 3-4 years.
Thank you. Well, that was Write Club, the podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so that every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club, the podcast. Please leave a review and do tell all of your friends about us. Bye.
Bye.